KQED.
Welcome to this KQED Public Radio Public Affairs Special. I'm Amy Standen. On February 18th, 2014, the Computer History Museum in Mountain View presented Padmasri Warrior, Chief Technology and Strategy Officer for Cisco Systems, in conversation with Laura Seidel, Digital Culture Correspondent for National Public Radio. Here to introduce the program is John Holler, President and CEO of the Computer History Museum.
The face of innovation is changing all over the world, and one of the women at the vanguard of that change is Padmasri Warrior. She has moved with a combination of grace and determination for her entire career, from her initial education at the India Institute of Technology, Delhi, to a master's degree in chemical engineering at Cornell, and then to her first job at Motorola in Arizona. It was an act of courage for Padmasri to take that first job in semiconductors. Her instinct was to choose academia. But she gave herself a year, and she ended up staying for 23. John Chambers, the CEO of Cisco, relentlessly pursued her to join his company. And after a year of saying no, she finally said yes. And today, she is the Chief Technology and Strategy Officer for that $43 billion company. She writes and speaks with passion and insight about what it has taken to reach this point in her career and what she's learned along the way. She is one of the most influential and most articulate people in technology today, and we're happy to have her with us as a revolutionary tonight. Leading this conversation is NPR's Laura Seidel. We're glad to have Laura back. It's her fourth time on our stage as moderator. She was last here with Marissa Mayer, about 6 months before Marissa was named as the CEO of Yahoo, and that interview just surpassed 250,000 views on our YouTube channel. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Padmasri Warrior and Laura Seidel.
So, I was saying this could be the stroke of luck. Next, she's going to be a CEO of somewhere. But I do feel like these days you're a rock star. I keep seeing you all over the place, and I'd like to talk a little bit about how you ended up in technology. In fact, I didn't realize until I looked at your LinkedIn page that your background was in chemical engineering, and so. How did a nice chemical engineer like you end up at Motorola, and what was that like to go from chemical engineering to chips and phones? And
I used to do all these experiments at home that were designed to find out how things worked, and used to drive my mom crazy because I don't think they were always the safest experiments, science experiments to conduct in the kitchen.
Did you blow up the house?
not almost, but not quite. So I think I always was interested in science. I went to IIT, Indian Institute of Technology, which is a pretty hardcore engineering school, very competitive, very difficult to get into. And, you know, when you go to that school, I went away from home. I grew up in the southern part of India and moved to North India in Delhi to go to school. You go thinking you're the smartest person on the planet because getting into the school is really difficult. And once you go there, you realize you're not. So I think that's the first experience in humility, realizing that true scientists and true technologies are always learning. And if you have the ability to learn, you discover new things. So I left India after my undergrad to go to Cornell, worked there on my graduate degree in chemical engineering, but with a specialization in electronic materials. So my research work was in figuring out how you make materials that would create semiconductors. So that's kind of how I ended up working for Motorola Semiconductor with the intent of going back and finishing up my PhD, which I never did. I just stayed in the industry and continued to work and then switched from electronics and semiconductors to building large-scale systems and then eventually became the CTO for Motorola and subsequently Cisco.
So those early years, I mean, you were a young person at this company learning something new. At the time, I believe you were also a young mother on a factory floor. And how was it, you know, in that situation?
Yeah, it's pretty traumatic, actually. I think it's I think juggling all these things is harder than we think, or harder than we can expect or plan for. So I was running a semiconductor factory. I had responsibility for 7x24-hour engineering support of the factory. Billions of dollars of equipment is used in making semiconductor chips. So to keep these machines up and running is a huge responsibility when I had my son. I learned at the time that, and I subsequently talk about this now all the time, you can't expect to have perfect balance. You know, to me, people ask me, how do you balance work life and your family and your work? Because I think if you kind of think about it as balance, it suggests somehow you're spending equal amounts of time on everything, or you're prioritizing all things at the same time all the time, and that's not possible. And I kind of learned that when I was, you know, raising my baby. I was supporting this big factory. I had a huge responsibility. I think you have to come to the realization that any given day you make certain decisions. One day you may prioritize going to work, leaving, you know, your son may have a ear infection. You leave them at a childcare. It's okay. They'll survive and they'll grow up. And another day you may decide to miss an important meeting to stay home with your baby, and that's okay too. The customer meeting still happened without you. And I think what I realized is it's not the decisions you make, but the guilt associated with those decisions that causes stress. So I told myself, and I tell young parents and all parents, don't feel guilty about the decisions you make. It all works out in the end, and I think that's a big learning that I had.
Yeah, well, just being present as opposed to thinking, oh, I should have been home, I should have stayed home, I think, right? Which we all do. You think, oh, I made that decision, oh, I should have made the other decision. So you left Motorola, you came to Cisco, and now you are chief technology officer, and you're also in charge of strategy. So tell me a little bit about what that means specifically in terms of managing the strategy for Cisco.
Yeah, so I came to Cisco 5 years ago almost 6 years ago now as the chief technology officer. Subsequent to that, I ran engineering for Cisco. I ran all of our enterprise products and product development and engineering. Very large group of engineers reported to me. And about a year and a half ago, I moved over to the strategy role. Strategy at Cisco entails mergers and acquisitions, partnerships, strategies, integrating the companies that we acquire, and actually looking further ahead into the future to think about big transformations. So that's my current role. So what does that mean? You know, I think Cisco is a very acquisitive company. We kind of look at acquiring startups and investing in companies as a way of innovating. You know, we spend a lot of dollars and investment on internal R&D, which is what I was doing before. But in the last 12 months or so, we've acquired 15 companies. So how you select which company to acquire, how we integrate them, that's my current responsibility. So we think about innovation really as having building our own technology, buying technology or companies, and partnering as the three big pillars. So I'm now responsible for the buy and the integrate part of those technologies. That's my current role. For the partnership strategies and the future things, you know, one of the things that we believe is from a technology evolution point of view, we're about to enter the next wave of the internet. If you think about internet evolution from the time we all started using it, the first wave was really about digitizing connectivity, right? So email was the killer app,
right,
in the early days of the internet. And we've actually, if you remember, in the early days of email, we were all like taught to use emoticons, you know, smiley face, frowny face to express emotions, because the only way to communicate on the internet back then was through text. And then we kind of digitized transactions, which gave rise to e-commerce. Mm-hmm. We started using the internet to conduct business transactions. And then the last decade, or maybe 5-6 years, was more about digitizing interactions, the rise of social and how we make friends now, and how you can, you know, communicate with a larger group of people. So going forward, the next wave, we believe, is going to be about the rise of Internet of Things, you know, machines right. communicating with other machines, and what does that mean from a business opportunity? So from a strategy point of view, I kind of look at these big transformations and think about how do we position ourselves as a company and how do we drive the rest of the industry to innovate to make that vision a reality.
I want to talk to, I'm sure many people in the audience are familiar with the idea of the Internet of Things, or I believe John Chambers has called it the Internet of Everything.
Everything, yeah.
But this is really connecting everything. This year at the Consumer Electronics Show, there were so many things on display from, you know, refrigerators, healthcare devices. I mean, I'm wearing a Fitbit, which, you know, lots of people mm-hmm. have. You know, Nest, which was just acquired by Google, you know, is a thermostat that's connected to the internet and knows when you're home. So where does Cisco see its role yeah. in this world?
Yeah, so we call it the Internet of Everything for a reason. And, you know, the reason we call it that is, you know, it's not just about connecting one machine, connected devices, if you will. You know, just to give you some stats, today there's roughly about 10 billion connected devices, devices that are connected to the network. That number, we think by 2020, will go up to 50 billion. And that 10 billion, by the way, although it sounds like a large number, is only 1% of the physical world. So the things in the physical world that could be connected, only 1% of that is connected, and that is about 10 billion connected devices. So if you just think about the potential we have when the 99% of our world wakes up, you know, think about that possibility. That is what we call the Internet of Everything. So it's this. How do you connect the things with people, process, and data? And that's going to revolutionize manufacturing, retail, healthcare, banking, transportation. All these verticals will look very different in the future. So the opportunity we see for a company like Cisco is obviously the connectivity part, no doubt, mm-hmm. right? You know, so we are pretty much a developer of every kind of a connectivity technology that is wireless to wire to the backbone of the internet. But then more importantly, how all of this data, as it traverses to the network, how do you turn data into information that can create better, more efficient business processes? So that's sort of where we are looking at.
So for example, you know, what would be an example of
that? An example of that could be, let's say you have a connected car. There's a lot of information in the car, but that car still, if it's just a connected car, is still not communicating with traffic. Traffic lights, for example, or congestion. So if you could then take that information in the car and have it communicate to a traffic light or information from the traffic lights coming to the car, it would know how to adjust its speed, or traffic congestion information. Perhaps we would guide you to take a different route, those kinds of things. You know, we are working with several cities to deploy what we call smart cities. As newer, younger cities come online, as the world urbanizes, is there a way to build these cities differently with more technology, like smart metering, smart street lights, for instance? If every street light had a Wi-Fi embedded mm-hmm. access point, you could actually have a connected street light that could send information, so it would lower crime rates, for example. So it's all kinds of
How would it? I'll take you back. So how would, you know, connected street lights lower crime?
Yeah, so if you think about today, it costs cities a lot of money to light up the cities. So most crime occurs in dark alleys where the light is not working, or you don't know, the city worker doesn't know that light is not working. So if these lights had some kind of a connectivity, they would send information to the city worker saying that that street, it's poorly lit, and by the way, the lights went out, they need to be replaced, or it would automatically go to a backup. Those kinds of things, right? And
right.
then if there's an alert, for example, if there's a crime occurring, you could seek press for help, and that information would be transferred to a public safety officer. So those sorts of things, and there's many, many use cases like this.
You know, we've talked a little about this, but a big topic about all of this is the issue of privacy and security. Mm-hmm. I mean, the minute we walk down this road, you start to think, well, if all this information is online, if my home is connected, if my fridge is connected. I actually had some conversations with people when Nest was acquired by Google. You know, some people actually got nervous about having a thermometer that was telling Google when you're home and when you're not home. They were like, do I want Google to have all that information? And it raises all these questions. And of course, now with what's gone on with the NSA, how do you think about this? How do we deal with this when you're going to have connected cities, connected
homes? No, I think it is a challenge, right? And the more information you give about yourself, the better the response and the preference engines are to serve you. So there's this dilemma about the more information you share about your location, your preferences, the technology can learn from that and serve you where it can preempt what you're looking for and make suggestions, etc. So the better it'll function. At the same time, there is the issue of privacy, how much information is too much information. So I think we need to have, as a society, a lot of these debates, right, about what is the right amount of sharing, how much access do you have. From our perspective, it's all your data. At the end of the day, it's the user's data, mm-hmm. So you have rights about your data, and it should be, you should opt into it. But the issue is today you don't know what you're supposed to be opting in and opting out for. So I think we'll have to come up with those newer technologies that make it visible to you.
Does Cisco get it? I mean, how involved is Cisco in that kind of work and trying to come up with technologies that enable us to make sure we can have some say over what happens to our information?
Yeah, I think the focus we have is from the perspective of the network, right? Now, the network actually kind of looks at how the data is traversing the network and there's knowledge there. We look at what kind of analytics will actually make it better for you as a user or a business, if the business is deploying it, for you to be more efficient. And so we always make it analytics served up where the user or a business has the right on what to do with that data. So we're not a consumer company per se.
Right.
We mostly focus on enterprise. So I think we have less of an issue to deal with, mm-hmm. Consumer privacy and consumer rights issues. But we think about it more from the context of an enterprise and how business processes can be improved.
You know, one area, and I think this is a really complex issue. You know, Cisco is a huge multinational company. It's in a lot of different countries. It's in China. It's in, countries in the Middle East. You're also dealing with countries that have a variety of laws about data and security. How do you, at a company like yours, think about navigating a country like China, which, I think, having been there and actually having had the experience of interviewing a human rights activist who ended up in prison, but who said he preferred having the companies there rather than not. Still, it's a really complicated question. When you're giving servers, you're putting them in China, we know they have the Great Firewall. How do you think about that as a technologist?
Yeah, I think from our perspective, our brand is really important and it stands for something. So when we build products, we make sure there is no extra access for anyone for any reason. So we don't make any special allowances for any government to do anything with that mm-hmm. information. We build the products that way. I think in general, if you think about this world where everything is going to be connected, regulation has to change, privacy laws have to change, and standardization has to change. So in as much as possible, we really facilitate those discussions. For example, we held a World Forum for the Internet of Things in Barcelona in September. We brought together country leaders, industry leaders, to really debate this issue about when you have these things connected, firstly, how can we cooperate to make that a reality, and secondly, how do we deal with challenges like this? So I think we try to take a neutral view of how do we do that. In terms of how we do business, we never compromise what our company's values stand for, and that's a big priority for us. And so that's how we work. I mean, we have a large presence in China. We do a lot of work in China. But at the same time, it is not, we never allow our products to get compromised. So I think it is a fine line. And I think as you pointed out, these discussions need to happen at the country level, at the industry level, and at the company levels.
I do think it's complicated for companies that come from the United States. Or, and it's not just China. I mean, Twitter got itself into issues in France because French law is very different around speech. So it wherever you go, you're going to be running into these issues as the internet gets more connected.
Right. Right, and I think we will evolve. I think we'll get there. I'm a big believer in technology. I think when there is demand, regulation has to follow and support that. So actually, I was at the World Economic Forum, and one of the big topics was around privacy and how data laws and all this has to change. And it was a cross-section of regulators, technologists, and users all debating the issue. So I think the first thing to do is to talk about this and make the necessary changes in regulation to occur. From our perspective, what we are most interested, firstly, by the way, I think there's also technology challenges that have to be solved.
Well, yes, there's that.
Right? And there's also interoperability and standardization. So there's a lot more work we can do as an industry while we challenge the regulators to think differently about some of these futures. And there are countries who adopt technologies, you know, early adopters of technology. We were talking about South Korea being one of them, and many pockets of Europe, actually. Smart grid is gaining a lot of traction there. So I think different verticals in how they adopt IoT or Internet of Things or Internet of Everything is changing.
How much in your role now do you end up just dealing with what is technologically possible, and how much do you deal with the implications of it? Or do other people in the company deal more with
that? No, I deal with this. Actually, it's really becoming very interesting. I think one of the things that I find is interesting about my job is not just technology. It's actually more of my time I spend on business model changes. What we sell and how people buy things and how we consume all of this is going to be very different. So it's really a question of technology, business model change, as well as the implications, the societal implications, as well as the implications on human interactions, user interface. How do we simplify all of this? I think it's really these circles, which used to be very distinct and separate, are blending together.
That's what I wondered. It seems that way to me. Now, I know that a topic that does interest you is getting more women into the world of technology. And, you know, unfortunately, the stats I've seen show it's actually gotten worse in recent years, and which is really unfortunate because it's becoming even more a part of our world. I'm curious if in your, you know, moving up the ladder, you've had an incredibly successful career. Have you ever felt a sense that, you know, people were like, well, she's a woman, she can't do that, or looked at you differently even along the way for you that made you feel less comfortable?
Yeah, no, I think it is a reality, and we need to change that, definitely, and that's why I feel so passionate about that. I mean, I think actually women's enrollment in the STEM fields, I serve on the board of trustees for Cornell, and I look at the data overall in science and engineering and math fields. The enrollment in undergrad schools is increasing. So more women are enrolling for STEM fields, and they're graduating with higher GPAs and in larger numbers. But if you look at the industry, in the workforce, the numbers haven't changed at all. And so that tells me it's not necessarily a supply issue anymore, because I think there are more women out there if we look for them and we hire them. And then how do you keep them in the workforce and develop them? And I think it is one of my key messages is, and I hope I can share this from my experience, women always, at least when I entered the workforce, we were told because you're an engineer, you have to behave a certain way or you have to act a certain way, which I think imposes an artificial shield on what women really want to be. And I think so they take themselves out of the running or they feel like they cannot be women and be great engineers. And I think that's a myth. You know, what I tell people is, first and foremost, what matters is results and performance. And so you can truly be genuine and true to yourself and your personality, whoever you are. And I think the more role models we can create for that and change the environment where it is such in presented that way, women will stay longer. I think we hire them in the industry, but they don't stay and have great careers, and that's the thing we need to change. Especially, I'm talking more, not just the tech industry, but technical women in the tech industry are much fewer.
Why do you think they don't stay? I mean, that...
Because I think there's a stereotype that somehow engineering is not for women, right? No, it's a very geeky field. It's a very detail-oriented problem solved. That's what engineers do. We solve problems. And it's considered not to be an intuitive field. But I think engineering is changing, too. It's fast becoming a multidisciplinary thing But just as we were talking about, it's not just the technology, the implications of the technology, how it's used, what is the business model. And the more multidisciplinary it gets, I actually think women engineers have a chance to do better at it because we are better at dealing with multiple inputs to solve the problem.
So they say, yeah, actually I'm figuring out a problem in the back of my head right now as we speak. No. I know that you have also, you used this word integration, which you used earlier too, rather than work-life balance. What do you mean by it really? Like when you use the word, why is it integration rather than balance? And
yeah, you know, as I said before, to me, balance somehow suggests there are two opposing things that you're trying to constantly keep in check, right? No, one thing doesn't overtake the other. And I think that suggests perfection, and life is not perfect, as we all know. And to me, integration is really being mindful of the fact that there are not actually just your work and your family, but when I talk about integration, I talk about yourself and your community. And to me, those are the four things that you have to be truly mindful of and be aware. And I think if you, I think one of the things, the reason I say that it's not just your work and your family, often what happens we neglect ourselves. You know, I, at least when I was, you know, I had a young son and I was working, I was trying to keep my home perfect and my work perfect. I was totally neglecting myself. And I think that harms your physical health, your emotional health, and in a way affects your creativity. And I think that's a realization. And if you're mindful of that, you pay attention to what drives you as a person. And that is different for each person. You know, for some people, it's exercise and running. And for others, it's music. For me, it's art. I like to paint. So whatever it is, I think you have to find that inner source of energy and creativity for yourself, and you have to feed that. And so that's why I like the word integration. And to me, the community is important, too. I like to belong to this community and be part of this community. So in whatever way you can give back to your community, I think that, that also fuels your creativity. So that's why I talk about integrating these four aspects. It doesn't mean you spend equal amounts of time on each of these four things every single day, or it doesn't mean that you're not going to have to make compromises, because life is full of compromises, but at least being mindful allows you to flex between those four dimensions.
As I'm curious, as a manager, do you encourage the people who work for you to go write haiku or do other things rather than just slog away at the desk?
Absolutely do. In fact, I force some of my people to take vacations because, you know, we get into the habit where we let our vacation expire. And I tell people, no, you're taking your vacation. And when you're on vacation, I don't want to see emails from you. And actually, by the way, I realized that this is also your own behavior. Before, I would be on my device and I'd be emailing things. And when I was running engineering, you don't realize it. But when you send an engineer an email, they feel compelled to reply to you. So there are, you know, you're making them work without
getting
perhaps.
Laughter.
I didn't really expect a reply right away. It could have waited till Monday. But so I now make sure that I don't do that unless it's absolutely necessary. And I, for myself, I create this thing. I think I talked to you earlier about this. I call it my digital detox day. Saturdays are my days as much as possible if I'm not traveling that I spend time on the physical world and things that are important to me, whether it's music or going to the movies or having friends over. And I do these chat sessions at work, especially with new employees that come to the company, new engineers and women engineers. I talk to them. And I always, when we do this introduction, I notice this. You know, if you have a group of 10 people that you're working with and you say, introduce yourself, what do people normally say? You know, usually 99, try this experiment next time. 99% of people say, I'm Padma Shree Warrior, I'm the CTO, or I'm, you know, Laura Seidel, I work for NPR, or whatever.
Right.
We always identify ourselves with our job and not who we are as human beings. So I tell people, don't just tell me your job title and which group you're in, tell me one fun fact about it, yourself. And it's amazing, people's eyes light up. It just could be one thing. Somebody will say, oh, I just had a baby, or somebody will say, I play in this rock band, or someone will say, oh, I'm a runner. And it's amazing, you know, and suddenly everybody becomes human, and that changes the whole dynamic. So it's a very simple thing, but that is, to me, that is about integration and being mindful.
You're listening to Padmasree Warrior from the Computer History Museum.
And it seems that the kind of work that you do and that engineers do is very rational. Mm-hmm. I don't know now, and actually I'm going to take a sidebar here and just say, how much of what you do now really is still involved in the nitty-gritty of engineering?
Yeah, it's now more my role is I look more at Uber architectures rather than specific products. For example, you know, this Internet of Everything. What is, you know, you asked me, what is Cisco's role going to be? So I kind of think about what's our role going to be, what are the architectures we want to build, how will we provide that analytics, and how do we ensure security? So I think it's much more designing the architecture versus designing a product. So that's a big transition. So I'm involved in quite a bit of nitty-gritty at the architecture level, and I have leaders who do the product. Our product development organizations actually build the products and deliver the solutions, which is what I was doing earlier.
You've done that work, so you can supervise people who are doing it. But it is very rational work, so it sounds to me like kind of what you're saying is take a break from that. And I think I believe you have said that when you did, you actually found that you were more effective at it.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, it is very... somebody said to me recently, there's a difference in saying data-driven and data-informed. I think my role now is moving. I was an engineer, I was more data driven. You know, I mean, you look at it, engineering is a very analytical field, as you pointed out, right? You know, you're problem solving, you look at a set of constraints, you have certain set of constraints, and you're developing solutions within those constraints. When you think of my role now, it is more data informed, right? I look at data and you think about making informed decisions with that data, as much of data as you can get. And when you're doing that, and that is a big change, you are taking some level of risk and you're using judgment based on, okay, I'm going to bet on this or I'm going to acquire that company because I think they have this technology that's going to fill a gap we have. And if you don't kind of step back and think of the big picture, you can get caught up and make rash decisions. So that's why actually taking a break and, you know, whether it's whatever it is, in my case, I paint and write haikus and coming back to it, you're able to look at the, you know, problem in a different dimension. You're still solving the problem, but you're looking at it from a different view. I think that's really important.
Because, yeah, a lot of times you do sort of imagine people doing this kind of work, and they're just, you know, totally frozen at a screen or inside, you know, and there's no time to take a break. And I know for myself I get a little crazy.
So what do you do to take a break?
What do I do to take a break? Oh, I don't take breaks. yoga, and I'm a movie buff, you know. I write poetry, and so I have my own thing.
You have
so
your
to
own
get my own thing. I like words, so I'm not an engineer. I just write about them.
Great.
So, but you know. One of the things, though, in the corporate world is that, and in terms of women moving up to leadership positions, I think people also think of it, it's pretty rough and tumble. I mean, it's a tough world out there, and it's good to be thinking about writing haiku and all of that, but there is a certain attitude, I think, of, you know, oh, this is tough business, you make a mistake, you predict something wrong. I was doing some reading, you know, research before I came here, and, you know, somebody gave you a hard time about not seeing the iPhone coming and being successful, and, you know, but this happens, mm-hmm. right? How do you, I guess, gracefully deal with that? People think, oh, women are, they're not going to be able to handle tough stuff.
I don't know if there's a graceful way to handle criticism. It always hurts. We're all human at the end of the day. When you read the, you know, critical articles or someone says something, you go, ooh, that was mean. Why did they say that? So I think, everybody goes through that. But I think as a woman, you know, as women, because there are fewer numbers of women in the technical companies and technical fields, there is a tendency for women to be second-guessed more. So perhaps we get more of that. And, you know, I people tell me, like, oh, you should, people, I've heard people give other people advice, just get a thick skin, and that's, I don't think that would be my advice, because it's impossible to do that, you know. My thing is, I think focus on the bigger picture and where you want to go. And I actually challenge people that, you know, give me critical feedback, like, tell me why you feel that way, or tell me why you think I'm wrong. And sometimes you change your mind based on that information. But it is hurtful because I think you are challenged more and you think, like, why am I getting challenged more than so-and-so? But I think you can't let that stop you. I think you have to really believe in the vision and the passion. And the other tactic I use is I create a followership. I get enough people to really believe in the vision that I'm presenting. And then, you know, then there is a critical mass of people that sort of support your vision. And so I work on creating a followership. And actually these days with social media, it's easier to do that too. I think you do find like-minded people who believe in this vision that you're presenting or your strategy. But that doesn't mean you're not going to have critics. I think in a very visible role in a large company, there will be things that I'm sure you will do wrong and people will criticize you for. You will do right and people will criticize you for. So that's just the breaks.
Well, with the Internet of Everything, I mean, this is also, it's an opportunity for Cisco, but there are also enormous challenges for you, like why your company? I mean, people are asking this. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of pressure, I would imagine, at this point on you to sort of make the right choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting time in the industry because the old IT model that we all kind of grew up in the industry where, you know, companies like Cisco really became the leaders, the client-server model is all getting disrupted, right, with mobile devices and the cloud changing this whole client-server model. And so the IT companies of the old have to reinvent themselves, and Cisco has to position ourselves. I think the reason I feel confident that we will be one of those companies that will rewrite the rules once again is we've done it before. I think it has had a history of reinventing itself. And if you think about Internet of Everything, obviously it's not going to be Cisco won't be the only company that will benefit from it. I think it'll really depend on who will adopt that change faster. The reason we believe we will be one of the winners is really the network is the connectivity vehicle. Mm-hmm. And without connectivity, you really can't have the Internet of Things. And so that is a prerequisite in one way. But it's not just the plumbing or the connectivity. It's actually how you provide solutions to a manufacturing floor that has automation, you know, or an oil and gas field where you're drilling and you have sensors at the end of the drill bit. All of that data cannot be trucked back to a cloud, moved back to a cloud. You need to have some capability to analyze and process that information locally.
Yes.
And so I think we call it distributed computing model. Mm-hmm. So we're coming up with newer architectures that we feel will position us to be a leader in this future.
But it's definitely a lot of pressure.
It is. But that's what makes it fun.
That's what makes it exciting. I want to get back to, you know, women in technology, and it's interesting. I often find resistance to talking about this topic, too. We actually did a conversation. We were in Dublin at the same time, and we did a conversation at a women's lunch. And we talked about the topic, and I talked about technology as well. The reason I find it challenging is I find a lot of women who are in tech often don't want to talk about it because I think they feel like they just want to talk about the work. And yet I feel like it is important.
I think it's very important. It's very important for many reasons. I think women should and must feel comfortable, you know, being a woman is fine. You know, I think maybe they don't want to talk about it because somehow I'm expected to talk about shoes. And maybe I am, by the way, I love wearing shoes and I talk about my shoes all the time. I am, no? And that's fine. That doesn't make me any less of an engineer. And I think, you know, it's that being a woman and being feminine is fine in tech, and I think encouraging other people to be authentic to whoever you are and whatever you like being as a human being is fine. So I talk about it all the time, and I talk to it about women engineers within the company, in the industry. I actually travel to other tech companies to talk to their women's group. I think the sad part is there's such few of us, and so I do really believe there needs to be a support network, and there has to be you know, a way that we can support and help each other.
I actually had a conversation once with, I went to an event at Stanford. It was a mentorship event for startups. And the room was largely male. There were a few women. And as we walked out, and I was working on a story, all the women ended up sort of gathering around, and they had a conversation about how getting through graduate school and all of this, it was actually really helpful to have somebody to team up with.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it made you feel I don't know, a little camaraderie right. or something like that.
Yeah.
This idea of being a little different, I mean, you talked about your management style. Do you think there are any ways in which gender affects how you manage people or how you think through problems? I know this is, it's kind of, I don't want to say that it's like makes you better or worse, but just different.
Yeah, I'm sure it does, whether consciously or subconsciously, I don't know. I think in my case, I truly believe that I always have an opinion on everything, right? You know, I think you don't get to doing my job without having
yes.
a point of view. But I'm also, I make a joke out of it. I'm humorous when I go to a meeting. I'll say, okay, I'm going to put my agenda on the table. Here's my point of view. I do have an opinion on this, but I'm willing to debate and listen to that. I think that's where perhaps my style is different, and perhaps women's style is different. It's not a command and control. Here's my opinion and my way or the highway kind of. That's not my approach. But you do have to be opinionated and formulate. This is my thinking. This is what I'm here to tell you. If you disagree, debate with me. And my team does. I think they always know. They're like, okay, we know that's your point of view, and we debate. We just had an offsite, actually. We had huge debates. And at the end of the day, what we walked out of the room is different from what I started the day with. Perhaps in that way, my style is maybe different from my peers. I don't know. But I do think that gender does perhaps play a role.
I don't know
if it's conscious or subconscious. I don't know.
If you were giving advice to young engineers, and as you do at your company, in terms of moving up the career ladder, integrating their life, what advice do you tend to give?
Yeah, I would say go for the opportunities. I think women tend to want to evaluate things to the nth degree. I mean, like, they always weigh pros and cons, and they can't make up, they let a lot of opportunities go because they'll, analyze, the risks associated with making a change, or I have an opportunity to take this new job, but I'm not sure, maybe I'm not ready, it's not exactly my domain. Whereas if the same thing is presented to a man, they'll go for it, right? They're out there with their resume, they're selling themselves, they're marketing themselves. So I tell women, some evaluation is good. Don't take unnecessary risk. You don't want to move too far away from your core competency. But don't get caught in this analysis paralysis. At some point, you have to go for opportunities because they're not going to wait there for you. And, I did that in my own case, right? I'm a chemical engineer. I went into the semiconductor industry, and then I moved to a systems company. Then I came to Cisco. I think you do have to, when an opportunity comes your way, go for it. And I think have the self-confidence. Because at the end of the day, I'm sure, women will be brilliant at doing in those roles, but they somehow hold themselves back. So take advantage of the opportunities and go for those opportunities. I think in retrospect, I wish I had made more change in the earlier days of my career, because I think even I was in that mode of maybe I'm not ready, maybe I should get more experience before I take the next step.
But now you're ready for the CEO position. If you're talking to somebody, too, just about what you do, what do you find most exciting about technology?
I think the possibilities of how it will change our world and how it has already changed our world in so many ways is what is intriguing. We don't even know what this Internet of Everything is going to look like 5-10 years from now, right? Just in the last 5 years, look at all the apps we use today in our mobile devices, and 5-6 years ago, that world didn't exist. And today it does, right? We were talking about how dependent we are on our devices, and I feel really insecure if I lose my phone for a day. It's one thing to put it somewhere and know it's there. I know it's in a safe place, but if I can't find it, then I'm terrified. And I think that kind of, I think just that fact that it is so powerful, and what it can, the way it's changed so many lives is unbelievable. I mean, the fact that I'm here on stage talking to you, I grew up in a very tiny town in southern India. I would have never dreamed that I'd be leading technology for a large technology company in the world. And I think that's the possibility of technology.
We were talking about this right before we came out, too, that as the Internet spreads, we get to see each other more. And we travel more, we see people in different places more. Now, I believe I also read, and you told me your husband is also an engineer. Mm-hmm. So that's a big part of your relationship, too, is
talking about these things.
Right, but my son is a writer.
He's like, I've had enough of this. I do understand that my parents were both scientists, and I'm not.
He writes science fiction right now, though. My husband and I, we met in engineering school in India. We met when we were 17, and we've been together since. He's an entrepreneur now. He runs his own company. So do we talk about technology? It's such an integral part of our lives. But we also have many other interests.
Well, I know in Sheryl Sandberg is a friend of yours, and she talks about leaning in, and she also talks about having a supportive partner.
Yeah.
And so I would think actually it'd be great that if you can relate to what each other.
No, enjoy. I think that's very true. Cheryl's right on. Mohan, my husband, like I said, is probably my best friend. We've been together for a long time. I don't think we ever think of our roles in having a family or raising our son as you do this, I do this. It's like whoever is there does it. And I truly believe that the level of support and encouragement I get from him has really helped me to become who I am, not just as a leader, but as a person. And that is very important. I think having that support structure is important, whether it's from your spouse or your friends or your extended family, wherever it comes from, it's important to have that.
I also read, along with your integration and doing, you meditate. Mm-hmm. And is this something you do every day?
I do. I meditate every day at the end of my day before I go to bed for 20 minutes. I started almost 20 years ago, and I taught myself, and in the beginning I couldn't do it for more than 2 minutes. It was really hard for me to sit still for 2 or 3 minutes and not think about stuff. And now, after 20 years, I'm proud to say I can do it for 20 minutes. It really helps me. It helps me to be calm and to helps me to bring focus my mind in a fresher way when the next day starts. So I keep it up even when I travel on business. I find a quiet, when I go back to my hotel room, I take the time to do it.
And did you have to come to the West to learn to meditate, which of course was...
I did.
An Indian pastime. We got a few questions. This one, I kind of like this. What one major event has shaped who you are today and why?
I think the birth of my son, actually. When I had my son, I was working almost 5-6 years before I decided to have a baby. And I didn't realize what a big deal it was and how it would change my whole life. Until then, what I mean by that, I was very self-assured, I was very independent, I was very self-confident, I controlled my life, I knew exactly where I was going to be, what time, what I was going to do, who I liked being with, I was sort of very self-assured. And suddenly you have this human being who's dependent on you, and you realize that you can't plan everything. Things go awry, and it's okay. You have to kind of be flexible and go with the flow. So I would say, yeah, that totally changed my perspective on things. I talked about, integration. I think that was when I really realized I was striving to be perfect at everything and failing at everything miserably. And, I think you have to tell yourself it's fine if your kitchen isn't cleaned for one day. It's okay. It's not the end of the world, right? And so I think those kinds of tolerance and patience and just adjusting as things change, it's huge. And I think in the technology world, that's a huge lesson as a leader to have, because technology is never constant. So you have to have the ability of letting go, control, and learning and adjusting quickly.
I think J.K. Rowling said something to the same effect, like that you had to let something go, because she was a single mom trying to write, and it was like, some days the laundry's just not going to get done. What are the biggest struggles you've overcome as a high-ranking woman in technology?
Biggest struggles? I think perhaps just telling, I don't know if it's a struggle, but maybe it's an internal struggle. I think realizing that you're ready for a change and feeling like I've invested a lot in building a team and earning a reputation for being good at this, now you have to go somewhere else and prove yourself again. I think, you know, this is what I tell people, and this is my advice. In some cases in my career, I waited too long to make those moves because I just was so comfortable. I was so attached to the people that were working for me. They were sort of like my family. So I turned down opportunities to go to the next big thing or take a big promotion because I felt like, you know, I'm good here and I've built a reputation. If I go to that company in a new job, I have to start over again. So probably that own internal struggle was probably the biggest one.
Do you think women have that more than men?
I don't know. I certainly
I don't know if I can generalize.
But I think women do, maybe. I think we feel women also have a more of a, and it's always dangerous to generalize, but I think we do have a sense of loyalty more, you know, like feel loyal to the teams that we are leading and the people that we are working for, perhaps more than men do.
This is kind of a fun question.
I feel like I want to peek and see.
Which ones are you?
She's like,
What is your greatest fear in your current role?
My fear in my current role is that we are not, I always ask myself, are we moving fast enough? I think I've seen companies fail, not because they didn't see the future or anticipate the future, but couldn't turn quickly enough to take advantage of that. So that is my biggest fear, is like, although we are very nimble, very agile as a company, and right now, you know, my particular job is to look for innovation outside the company to bring that innovation in the M&A role that I lead, is to make sure that we are moving fast, making decisions quicker, and taking advantage of these opportunities that come up.
Right. I mean, I think actually Bill Gates saw a lot of things coming, but Microsoft didn't move quickly enough to get to them, you know, and anticipated tablet computers, but didn't quite get that one right. How do you make decisions on what ideas to back and what ideas to pass on?
Sorry, say that again. Well,
how do you make a decision if an idea comes your way or a company comes your way? How do you decide what to say yes to, what to say no to?
That's a great question. Actually, this is something that you learn. I think this is the advantage of being an engineer, right? You know, we talked about engineers are very problem-solving oriented. You kind of say, you know, I always ask the question, is this the right company? You know, when an idea comes up, all ideas sound great, right? The toughest thing is to decide what not to do and decide which one to bet on. I always look for true innovation. Is there something really unique here? And how do you know that? And how do you know if it's a true innovation or not? I look for, is there an incumbent already in the industry? If so, how different is this idea from what the incumbent already offers? You talked about tablet computers, for example. If there's already somebody providing that product, it's hard for people to switch, right? Then I also look for what problem is this really solving? What is the true problem it tries to solve? Then I look at the team. You know, we always look at, especially when we're looking at acquisitions, we look at talent. You know, that's really important. And we look for, in our company, we look for culture fit. You know, if this company we're acquiring, for example, Cisco is a very customer-centric company.
Mm-hmm.
And so all acquired companies, we look for, do they really think about customers first? Is that important in how they're thinking about our product? So there's some, you know, things that you look for in the companies in addition to the technology and the differentiation that are perhaps not quantifiable, but you try to get a feel for the culture fit and, of course, the talent fit.
Is there a company you can talk about that you decided to acquire that might be a good example?
Yeah, I can't name the companies, but there are several that we've engaged in conversation, and I say in some cases actually have gotten quite far, and we decided, no, it's not really a fit for us because the culture didn't work or something, you know, we hesitated about is the integrity there? Are they going to fit within the values that we carry? And we walked away from deals like that. Because at the end of the day, I think, you know, when you're a big company and are acquiring smaller companies, you are, in a way, you have to make sure you don't squash the culture that they have, because otherwise you lose the benefit of what you're acquiring. At the same time, you can't leave them alone too long, because then they don't get the benefit of the scale that you have. So it's this delicate balance of how quickly you integrate them without them losing the agility that they have. So I have a whole integration team that actually does this in a very thoughtful way.
Somebody asked, actually, to go through your day. What do you spend a day doing?
My assistant is here. We should ask her. Oh, wow. I think it depends. I spend a lot of my time with customers. Tomorrow, maybe I'll use tomorrow as an example. I start my day very early, 7:30. I would do preparation for a big meeting we're having with one of our largest customers. They're traveling here halfway around the world. I have a two-hour session with them, basically strategizing what they want to do in the future and how we can help them. And so I'm leading that discussion. So today we met internally with the Cisco team to prepare for that. So tomorrow my day will start at 7:30. I end with them. Then I'm talking to a group of people called the Research Visionary Board. So they come to talk to me about IT trends. Where do I see the IT industry growing? So I'll talk to them, brainstorm. It's sort of like this, talking about it, but in a more quantified way. Then in the evening, then I have meetings during the day with my own team members, looking at some startups, looking at some investments. I have a very late day tomorrow, a very long day. I have a 2.5-hour session in the evening with 40 analysts from, 10 different countries in Asia Pacific region. So we use our technology, telepresence, and they want to know about where is Cisco going to be, where's our growth going to come from. So I would say it's a two-hour grilling session where they get to ask me questions.
I mean, somebody actually asked a question along those lines, which you may get from the people who work for you. Can you give an example of a current business model of the current business model of Cisco and how it might look in 5 years?
That's a great question. So today Cisco basically sells products. We're a product company. We make switches, we make routers, we make video products, and we sell them to service providers or enterprises. Now, the two segments we serve is large enterprises, small enterprises, as well as telcos or service providers. I would say 5 years from now, we would be much more of a cloud provider. We would be providing larger scale solutions to be consumed as a service versus as a product. That would be one change in our business model. The other thing, I think we would be much more of a solution company, meaning we would... Today, for example, we sell wireless access points. A few years from now, we'll be selling a mobility solution. It's not just a wireless access point. How do we ensure there's security as devices connect in an enterprise? How do we authenticate? How do we provide single sign-on? How does all of that work together so the CIO doesn't have to deal with all these discrete problems? We would be much more of a software company rather than just being solely a hardware company. So I think these would be some shifts that we are making currently, and hopefully we will be in the leadership position in this.
So mobility in terms of taking the software wherever you go.
Yeah, all of that, right? Instead of just selling one point product like an access point today, we would come into, if this was a business, we would say we would build you your mobility solution. So that would include, as your employees come in, they'll have single sign-on. If there's a particular enterprise application they want on your mobile, we'd enable that to happen without losing your data security, making sure there's protection, all of that integrated as a mobility solution, for example.
Great. I have to say, too, you have the greatest name for somebody who's a leader. I'm sure you've been told that. Well, you're a warrior. Is it an Indian name?
It is an Indian name, my husband's last name. It doesn't mean the same thing in India. It's phonetically the same as the English word warrior, but it's very convenient, so I use it.
Well, on that note, Padma Warrior, thank you so much for spending time this evening with everyone.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Padmasri Warrior, Chief Technology and Strategy Officer for Cisco Systems, in conversation with Laura Seidel, Digital Culture Correspondent for National Public Radio. This program was recorded at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View on February 18, 2014. Major funding for this program was provided by the Intel Corporation. The recording engineer was Jane Heaven. The technical supervisor was Monte Carlos. I'm Amy Standen. Thanks for listening.